This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we'll be talking with Jane Goodall. But first, you had a bad day. You get into your car, you head home, you flip on the radio, and what happens? You hit the shuttle button, maybe, on your MP3 player or your iPod. Your favorite song comes on. And you're hearing that song, and it makes you feel joyful. I know Margo Adler just walked by. She said it made her feel great. Well, in addition to giving you a bit of a mental rush, believe it or not, it may have been doing your heart some good as well. In work presented this week at the meeting of the American Heart Association, researchers say that listening to joyful music can actually dilate your blood vessels and make it easier for blood to flow through them. And that song you just hate, the one that stresses you out, well, you're right. You might want to change the channel and get it off your playing list, because listening to that music can actually make your blood vessels constrict. Here to talk about the connection between your playlist and your heart health is Dr. Michael Miller. He's the Director of Preventive Cardiology at the University of Maryland Medical Center and Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore. Welcome to the program, Dr. Miller.
Thank you very much. Our pleasure to be here.
You actually tested this out on people.
We did. We tested this on a number of volunteers who actually enjoyed participating in the trial.
I'll bet. What did you have them do?
Well, what we asked them to do was to select a number of their favorite musical selections that they really enjoy. So we didn't want to force upon them music, whether it was classical or a specific entity. We wanted them to choose, based upon their previous experience, those individual songs or artists that made them feel good, gave them a sense of euphoria, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And then you brought them in and you had them listen to the music for a certain period of time?
Right. We did ultrasound testing of their upper arm in order to evaluate the inner lining of the blood vessels, how that responds. So, for example, we know that mental stress causes that inner lining to constrict. And our previous studies on laughter had demonstrated that we could expand those vessels after watching a movie that promoted a hearty chuckle, if you will. So in this particular experiment, we now had them listen to music for about 30 minutes.
And their blood vessels expanded.
I mean, the blood vessels
dilated.
Expand, right?
Wow.
On an average of about 25%, which is similar in magnitude to what has previously been observed with aerobic activity and also statin use.
That's amazing. You must have been surprised.
Yeah, we were pretty surprised. We were, again, the idea being whether or not there is a strong connection between the mind and the heart. And there appears to be. We've known that, of course, with respect to stress and anxiety-provoking situations.
Mm-hmm. And we've all heard about these endorphins that people get from the runner's high, things like that.
Exactly. And now, we don't know the precise biochemical mechanism, but endorphins would serve as one of our leading contenders here, because we do know that when you feel good, that endorphins are released. And the real question is there direct activation from endorphin release from the brain? Is there direct activation to the inner lining of the blood vessels or the endothelium, if you will? Or is there crosstalk between the release of endorphins and then activation, if you will, of nitric oxide, which is one of the primary chemical mediators that causes this expansion of the blood vessel?
Hmm. So you're saying that if you can have a good laugh, then listen to a good song.
Yes, and if you could have a little bit of dark chocolate with that while you're on your treadmill.
Wow, get them all in one place. Now, you know, sometimes for me, I mean, I know this works for me, hear a great song, it relaxes me, I feel better, it actually changes my mood. But it seems that there has to be sort of a time interval between it. You know, if I hear the same song every day, it's not going to work as well.
Well, you know, Ira, that I think is a critical point, and one of our recommendations in terms of asking our volunteers prior to them engaging in the experiment, we asked them to refrain from listening to their favorite music for at least 2 weeks. There's this effect called emotional desensitization. So, you know, if you listen to the same song that you hear on the radio, which is, of course, the problem with playing top 40 songs, so you like the song, you get a high, if you will, from it, but they play it over and over again, and then you become desensitized. And so, you know, if we were going to make a recommendation about listening to music on a regular basis as part of an overall heart-healthy program, we would say to listen to your favorite song, then put it away for a couple of weeks, and then switch off with other songs.
What I also found equally is intriguing is the opposite effect, that if you listen to unjoyful music, it constricts your arteries. There.
Right. Again, this is similar to what has previously been observed with mental stress, or asking somebody to subtract 7 from 100 mental arithmetic exercises. They promote a feeling of anxiety, and then other chemicals perhaps are released, overriding this beneficial effect, leading in effect either to no response or to, as you point out, some evidence of constriction.
Mm-hmm. So it's like watching a bad or a sad movie, I would imagine.
Yeah, depression has been shown to induce similar findings. Remember, the endothelium serves, the inner lining of our blood vessels serves as the gatekeeper to vascular health. And in fact, towards the development of hardening of the arteries, the earliest stage in that process is changes in the endothelium, such that there is endothelial dysfunction, if you will, prior to even the development of plaque formation.
Mm-hmm. Let me see if I can get a quick call in here from David in St. Louis. Hi, David.
Hey, I was calling about one. I don't remember what university did the study. I was in college 10 years ago, and the study may have been from 10 years before that. I don't remember, but they were testing the performance of the football team while they were lifting weights with different varieties of music. And if they were playing upbeat music or no music, their performance was about the same. The one that really stood out to me was if they played reggae, that literally, I guess if the players, for lack of a better term in music, feel the groove, that they would physically lift less weight while listening to reggae than listening to other
types of
music.
You mean more weight? They lift more weight while listening to reggae?
Well, no, they said their performance actually dropped off.
Oh, it dropped off. Oh, they didn't like the reggae.
No, it wasn't that they didn't like it. It wasn't whether they liked it or not. I guess it was just the fact that reggae is a rather low-energy type performance, and that their bodies kind of mimic that.
Let me get a reaction. Is it the fact that you have to like the like the music, or is that the factor involved?
Well, you know, obviously we didn't specifically evaluate that. The question is maybe they were too relaxed. And by being too relaxed, they just didn't have the motivation to lift the weight. So the reggae was so pleasing to them, they didn't feel like doing anything else.
Mm-hmm. Now, you only had 10 people. Is that enough to be able to say that this is a real effect?
Right. So these individuals participated in 4 different activities. And when you use yourself in what we refer to as a crossover design, then, in fact, because there is minimal variability, obviously, compared to having 2 different individuals participate, this would give you statistical power of more than 40 individual people.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, looking at the baseline measurements among the different phases were very tight.
Yeah.
We also had one individual, a gentleman named Charles Mangano, who's been doing this for 10 to 15 years and a real expert in the area, who did all the studies himself. So having one individual doing all the studies really, I think, with a lot of experience, helps to enhance its validity.
Well, then, is there something special about the music, or would any activity that makes you feel good also help your blood vessels?
Well, it's a great question, and clearly it's now been demonstrated for the 2 positive emotions, laughter. It's also been demonstrated, by the way, in dark chocolate. We know exercise also causes this beneficial dilatory effect, and now music. So my best guess is if we're promoting this idea of endorphin release, then it would be any kind of activity that would bring on a feeling of euphoria, if you will.
So there has to be some sort of emotional rush going on here.
I believe so. I believe that to be the case here. Now, again, we need to go back to the lab and evaluate the biochemical factors that may be promoting this. Jeffrey Ryan in my laboratory will be doing these analyses. But so I think there's more to the story to help us understand these mind-heart connections.
Mm-hmm. So your prescription for those of us listening this Friday and for the weekend?
Yes, my prescription is to, of course, never to take ourselves seriously to begin with, but secondly, to play music that we really enjoy, especially when we're in traffic and we can't do anything about it anyway. So you might as well put on something that will help to relax you, make you feel good, and then put it away for 2 weeks and then switch off with other music that makes you feel good.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you say make sure you don't listen to it too often because you're going to use yourself up, so to speak.
Right.
You're going to acclimate to it.
You're going to get the biggest rush, obviously, when you the first or second time that you've heard it, once you're, of course, familiar with it.
Well, we have a question from Twitter from Plainsight says, is there any objective data on what music is, quote, joyful or stressful, or does it depend on the person?
I really think it depends on the person, because obviously what music brings joy to you may not bring the same feeling of joy to your colleagues. And so I think, again, it's something that we need to obviously investigate, but individuals are so different, and it's really, I think, unique to that person. And it could be based upon previous experiences.
Yeah.
It could be based upon, the name of a song. For example, the song Lana from Roy Orbison reminds me of my daughter, Alana, based on the name. So there are a lot of things that may make you feel emotionally attached to it.
One quick question from Jay in Cincinnati. Hi, Jay, quickly.
Greg, I was just wondering, I like to sing. Sometimes I feel more connected, better well-being after I sing a song I love. Could I be getting a similar effect from singing, as you're talking about, from listening to happy music?
I think so. I think if it brings you, if it gives you that sense of euphoria, again, I think it's an emotional effect.
All right. Dr. Miller, we've run out of time. I want to thank you very much. Michael Miller, Director of Preventive Cardiology at University of Maryland Medical School. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
We're going to switch topics. Bring in Jane Goodall. If you'd like to talk to Jane Goodall, stay on the line. We'll have a long conversation with her. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. There's a short list of icons in science, people who are both excellent researchers, also public symbols of what science is and does. And to anyone who's a fan of magazines like perhaps National Geographic, Jane Goodall is one of those icons. From her groundbreaking work with chimpanzees in the Gambia in the 1960s to her tireless advocacy for the environment today, she has earned her place in the Science Hall of Fame. And she's back with us today. So without further ado, let me formally introduce my guest. Jane Goodall is a primatologist and an environmental advocate. She is co-winner of the 2008 Leakey Prize and is the founder of the Jane Goodall Institute based in Arlington, Virginia. And she joins us today from CBC Studios in Toronto. Welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
It's been too long. The last time you were on here was 2002.
Goodness.
Are you any more optimistic now about the prospects for the environment since then?
Well, I think I feel about the same. Mm-hmm. We're at a crossroads. We have been for the last several years. And if we don't take action, us collectively, then maybe it's too late. But we haven't got to that point yet.
Mm-hmm. Your group, Roots and Shoots, is an outreach to young people. It's been going now, for 17 years?
Yeah, since 1991, but it didn't really leave Tanzania until about 93.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's now in about 100 countries. It has programs from preschool through university, and even some senior citizens have formed groups, and it's in prison. So it's approximately 9,000 active groups.
Wow. And so some of these kids are now grown up. Have they gone out now on their own, making their own marks as adults?
Absolutely. And what I love is that one of the young Tanzanians who was with us right at the very beginning, he left school, he got a degree in the US, he got a job because he got a wife and family. But now that we have raised some more money and we can offer people employment, he's back being the Tanzanian national director of the program. And it's really wonderful to see this person who has never lost that commitment that he got as a child.
That's terrific. 1-800-989-8255. If you'd like to speak with Jane Goodall. There are still researchers out there in the Gambia observing the chimps. What kinds of things are they learning? I've seen you recently out in San Francisco. Seems like they're still learning all kinds of fascinating things about how the chimps behave.
Well, they really are. And, of course, a lot of what they're learning is the result of the long-term studies. It began in 1960, coming up to 50 years. Chimpanzees can live to be more than 60, so it does take a long time. But one of the more recent technologies we've been able to incorporate is DNA testing of fecal samples, which will tell us who the fathers are. We've never known before. So this opens up a whole new area. You know, is there possibly any special relationship between a father and his biological child? It's hard to see how that could be, but maybe there is. We don't know.
I have a question here for you from Second Life, and is it possible to balance activism and advocacy with scientific research without risking the objectivity of the researcher or your objectivism, as he puts it?
Well, I have, always have serious concerns about objectivity in science. Yes, we have to be objective, but we should not be objective at the expense of being a human. We should be able to have compassion and empathy at the same time as we can stand back and be objective about what's going on. But without that, if you don't allow yourself to feel some empathy or some compassion, then science can become, I think, a very cold, hard, and potentially dangerous profession.
Mm-hmm. You were just awarded the Leakey Prize for your work in evolutionary science. Now, I don't think most people have heard of what that means. Can you give us an idea what that whole field is about?
It's actually the reason I was able to get into this field at the beginning, because my mentor, the late Louis Leakey, he spent his life searching for the fossilized remains of early humans. Mm-hmm. And he felt, way ahead of his time, that if we understood the behavior of our closest relatives in the natural state, that's chimpanzees and then gorillas, orangutans, and bonobos, that this might help him to have a better feeling for how early humans might have behaved. Because the argument is, if you find behavior that's similar or the same in chimpanzees today and humans today, the modern human, modern chimp, then possibly that behavior was present in a common ancestor, ape-like, human-like, about 6 million years ago, and that therefore we may have brought that characteristic or those characteristics with us throughout our long evolutionary journey. And then he liked to, feel, yes, that will give me a better handle on how these Stone Age people behaved.
Mm-hmm. You still feel Louis Leakey around with you? Is he still present for you, Louis Leakey?
Oh, sometimes he is. He was such a larger-than-life character. And, he was such an amazing person.
He was a seminal figure in your life.
Well, absolutely. I mean, goodness, when he offered me this opportunity, I had no degree of any kind. I was straight out from England, and all he knew about me was that, one, I'd certainly read a lot about animals. I could answer lots of his questions. And two, when he let me go with himself, his wife, and one young English girl and a few Kenyans to Olduvai Gorge, now a very famous site of many human fossil discoveries. But in those days, there was nothing there. It was just animals. No humans had been found. And I think he was sort of watching how I behaved out on the plains and what I did when a young male lion followed for a good many yards. And that's when he decided to offer this opportunity to me.
Over these past 40 years, has your idea or your own definition of what intelligence means changed as you watch the apes, the primates, and even other animals?
Well, it's very, very clear. When I began in 1960, I was told, when I finally got to Cambridge University, that only humans had minds, and that animals other than human animals were incapable of anything like thinking. That was the accepted attitude of the European ethologists, the people studying animal behavior. And, of course, it's so obvious when you see these intelligent creatures out in the wild that they are thinking, that they definitely are capable of rational thought, and that's been substantiated again and again with experiments in the laboratory. Mm-hmm. So I think my feeling is probably about the same, mm-hmm. but I understand it better. Mm-hmm. But the majority of animal behavior scientists, their attitude has changed.
What kinds of things have you seen, for example, one or two things that changed, that would change someone who goes out in the field and sees the behavior?
Well, I think if you have the opportunity to watch young ones so closely observing the behavior of others and then imitating what they've seen and practicing it, tool using, and it's fascinating to see a young one invent something new, doing something different, and how the other young ones will watch that and sometimes imitate, which is how new cultural traditions are introduced into a group. And something which is very, very simple, but imagine a chimpanzee sleeping. He's stretched out on the ground by himself, sits up, looks around, scratches in a contemplative way, wanders over to a big tuft of grass, very carefully selects 2, 3, or even 4 blades, tucks them into that little pocket between chin and shoulder, and wanders off maybe several hundred yards to a termite heap that's completely out of sight. And there he inspects the heap, and if it's a productive one, he'll use the tools that he picked. Well, you know, if you don't accept that this is some kind of planning ahead and thought, how can you explain it?
Very interesting. 1-800-989-8255. Let's take some calls. Let's go to Jessica in Boise. Hi, Jessica.
Hi there. Thanks so much for taking my call, and it's so nice to be able to talk to you, Mrs. Gooding.
Go ahead.
It's good talking to you.
Go ahead, Jessica.
All right. I was actually just recently reading online about some cases of infanticide and cannibalism in chimpanzees. And specifically some cases that you were able to observe where there was a group of females that were stealing the babies from other females and actually eating them. And I had two questions. First, do you have any idea why such behavior has been occurring? And number two, I did read that in one particular instance you were able to save one of the infants. And how did that work as far as your objectivity? I thought that researchers generally were just supposed to observe and not interfere. And I will take my comments off the air.
Thank you, Jessica. Good questions.
Okay. Well, first off, we have no idea. It was one mother and her adult daughter who actually took the babies of other females. The most common infanticide is when a group of males is patrolling its territory, and if they see a stranger, if it's a female with an infant, or of course if it's a male, they may give chase. It's almost like hunting. And if they catch a female with an infant, they will attack her very, very severely, leave her probably to die of her wounds, take the infant, and sometimes kill and eat it. Usually they just kill it. But the female and her daughter was different because they were attacking females in their own group, not really to hurt the mother, but simply to take the baby and eat it. And they only did this when it was a brand new baby, as though the smell was different and maybe the baby was thought of as a stranger, or because there was blood, smell of blood from the placenta and the birth process. So we saw it in one other mother-infant pair, but they never succeeded. And I already talked on this show about objectivity. And mm-hmm. for me, these chimpanzees are, you know, they're just like people in a way. And we've always helped the chimpanzees if they're sick. you hear people saying, you must let nature take its course, but we have interfered so profoundly, so hugely, and so monstrously with nature that in most places it's not possible. Like mm-hmm. Gombe. Mm-hmm. Gombe, 30 square miles, once part of an uninterrupted forest, now a tiny little island surrounded completely by bare cultivated fields. And if we get fewer chimps than we have today, it's gone from about 150 to 100, then, you know, that's going to be the end. So mm-hmm. each one is precious from a genetic point of view.
Mm-hmm. We have a question here also from Second Life about your winning of the Leakey Prize. And it asks, and this is a very good question, who was your co-recipient?
I knew you were going to ask that. Well, and
you know, not many people know about the very famous Japanese scientist Toshisada Nishida. Who is he? And why is he so famous, at least in Japan and other parts of the world?
He was involved with the other longest-term research. So Gombe was the first, starting in 1960, and the research at Mahali began in 1966. And Toshisada Nishida wasn't the one who started it, but he was responsible for running it and carrying on the research and finding the funding for it for many, many years until he retired from that about 2 years ago. So I've known Toshi for years.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Jane Goodall this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Did the Japanese have a different way of studying in the wild than yours, or basically mirroring yours?
It was pretty much the same. I mean, I think that in some ways, fascinatingly, the Japanese started completely non-objective and the ethology. And, of course, in Europe and then America, it was very objective. But then as we learn more and more about these complex beings with their complex brains, England, the British mm-hmm. View of animal nature softened. And the Japanese, as they learn more and more about Western ways of science, hardened a little. So we ended up more or less exactly the same.
Hmm. Let's go to Sam in Michigan. Hi, Sam.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a quick question with regards to language being a very unique characteristic of the human race. Can you shed some light with regards to why we're so different in that sense? Has there been any recent studies to sort of correlate the evolution of this unique quality that humans possess?
People have different theories, really, about the origins of language, and I'm not sure we'll ever know. But I think what's fascinating here is that I believe it's because we have, for some reason or another, and it must have been many evolutionary pressures, I should think, which caused us to speak. But because of it, because we have the ability to teach about things that aren't present, to plan for the distant future, to discuss, and that's so important, so you can involve the collective wisdom of a group in discussing an idea. That, I think, is what's led to the explosive development of our intellect. And so although chimpanzees can do things intellectually we never thought they could, like some mm-hmm. of the amazing stuff they do with computers and things, you know, it doesn't make sense to compare a chimp intellect with human intellect. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, the question is, if we're the most intellectual creature that's ever walked on this planet, how come we're destroying it?
You said that we're not learning from our past mistakes. We're not listening to science.
In many cases, we're not learning from our past mistakes. Some science I'm not sure we should listen to, but mm-hmm. it's the past mistakes of history. We're not learning very well from those. We go blindly into warfare again, not seeming to think about the consequences. So We're a strange mixture, and we have a dark side, and we have a more noble side, and so do the chimpanzees.
What science should we not be listening to?
Well, it's not so much a matter of listening to, but, you know, I'm thinking of the kind of science that led to nuclear weapons, for example, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to take a short break, and come back and talk more with Jane Goodall, who is the winner of the 2008 Leakey Prize. Also here to talk with us for the rest of the hour, our number 1-800-989-8255 if you'd like to talk with Jane. Also, we're Twittering at SciFritter, SciFritter. And also in Second Life, so there are lots of different ways you can reach us this hour if you'd like to ask Dr. Goodall a question. She's also talking about more than just the chimps, talking about world problems, warfare, other things like that that she has very much taken up the cause for. So we'll talk to her about some of those causes when we get back. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatto. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. We're talking this hour with Jane Goodall, who has many, many accomplishments to her name, including her latest books, Harvest for Hope, A Guide to Mindful Eating. She has also written many children's books. Her latest one in that is Ricky and Henry, and Henri, A True Story with Alan Marks. That's put out by Penguin Young Readers Association. You're also involved in environmentalism, especially. Let's talk about something called the Forests Now Declaration. That's a very interesting concept and a declaration. Tell us what that is and what it's aimed at.
Well, the Forests Now Declaration is, if I'm remembering it correctly, because there are so many forest initiatives now, and I seem to be involved.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. I was going to drill down into one of them, but go ahead.
All right, drill down.
I heard you speaking about allowing third world countries and countries in Africa to become more market savvy in the natural resources that they have, so they get fair market for what they have there.
Well, that's something we're very deeply involved in, because when I flew over the Gombe National Park about 17 years ago in a small plane and saw the extent of deforestation outside the park, saw that the soil was no longer fertile, saw there were more people living there than the land could support, too poor to buy food, I realized that, you know, there was no way we could even try to save the chimps while the people were struggling to live. So that led to our Take Care program, which is basically community-centered conservation. And it's a holistic way of improving their lives in 32 villages around Gombe. And it's in ways selected by them, not by us. So they say what they need. And it's to do with different farming methods, reclaiming infertile land, reforestation, water and sanitation projects, working with groups of women, providing microcredit opportunities, scholarships for girls, HIV/AIDS and family planning information, everything like that. And then we discovered that high up in the hills was some really good coffee. So the farmers couldn't make money because there's no proper roads. So when I had the chance to talk to a group of coffee roasters in Seattle, I said, we need some of you guys to come out, see if it's really good coffee, and if it is, help us market it. Yeah. So Green Mountain Coffee Roasters was there within about 5 weeks or even less, and they found indeed the coffee was fantastic. They've been buying it. Other coffee roasters have come in to buy some as well, helping the farmers to develop ever better ways of harvesting and storing the coffee that they have. And because of this, this is why this is so exciting, because of this, the villagers are setting aside between 10 and 20% of their land for reforestation and forest protection in such a way that these forest patches will form a contiguous corridor of forest, so that the Gombe chimps, who at the moment are isolated, will once again be able to move out and interact with other remnant groups.
Now, some people might say, you know, you're turning the forest into coffee plantations.
No, because there's no trees left. The coffee is grown where they've already cut down the trees. The good news is that shade coffee gets the best prices. So the trees are coming back, and all of these forested patches are at the moment bare, but the regenerative power is such that if you stop chopping at the seemingly dead tree stumps, you get a 30-foot tree in 5 years.
Wow, that's pretty fast growing.
And also, the village management plan that each village is required to make sets aside so much percentage of land for agriculture, mm-hmm. and it can't be changed. So what's changing is the efficiency of the way they're growing coffee and other crops. Same amount of land used, but a much more efficient way of using that land. And the village management plan also includes the number of people that must live in that area. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, what with our microcredit and family planning information, women empowerment, it means that they can actually plan a family and they couldn't before. And we already see a trend of smaller family size, at the same time more infants living.
Yeah, because lots of studies have shown that education is the best thing you can do for people.
Yeah, yeah. Women's education, especially all around the world, yes.
Yeah. Let's go to Elizabeth Ann in Birmingham, Alabama. Hi, Elizabeth Ann.
Hi. I was wondering what you thought about the efforts of Orangutan Island in Borneo to return orphaned orangutans to the wild.
Yes.
Are you familiar with that, Orangutan Island?
Yeah.
What do you think? She wants to know what you think about it.
Well, I think, you know, as long as one can return animals to the wild without disturbing existing wild populations, that is the answer. I just wish we could do it with our chimpanzees. We're looking for a place where maybe we could return them to the wild, but you've got to find somewhere with no people because they're used to people and they would probably harm people. Same with orangutans. And no wild chimps, because the wild chimps are territorially aggressive and probably kill them. It's very hard to find places like that in Africa.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend. What is the greatest threat to chimpanzees today?
It depends, really, which part of Africa they're in. But, of course, the underlying threat is us. It's human population growth. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, you've got the habitat destruction just from people farming and so forth. You've got commercial hunting, the bushmeat trade, which is very prevalent in Central Africa with the last significant populations of chimpanzees, gorillas and bonobos are. And you have the logging companies, all foreign, which even if they practice selective logging, are making roads deep into the heart of the forest. And this is opening up the forest for hunting. And that's why the bushmeat trade has taken off. And it's involving lots of money. And it's the hunters shooting everything from elephants to birds and bats, smoking the meat and trucking it into the towns. So, you know, we're working there. We're working with the Congo Basin Forest Partnership. Mm. Partners being other NGOs, government, USAID and such like. And our job is to make partnerships with the local people.
Mm-hmm. Question from Second Life from Paxis, who says, does Jane have any advice for young people who want to pursue a career in biological science? What are some of the most crucial spaces that need to be filled by the next generation?
Well, that's a tough question. I'm not sure I can answer the crucial spaces. But the best thing to do, the only way that you'll get on in the biological sciences is by being really determined, really wanting to do it, working really hard, keeping your ears open for opportunities, going onto the websites of the different colleges that offer different kinds of experience to see exactly which one it is that you want to do. But there's just such a lot left to learn out there. And, of course, a big field opening up now is the effect of climate change, how this will affect different species, what can be done to help those species when this happens, because it will.
Mm-hmm. Question from RRW Twit, and we're tweeting. Jane, you may not even know what I'm doing here. Familiar with Twitter? That's sort of an instant message system that's being developed.
Oh, I see. And he said, a bird.
Well, we have a question about birds, but let me go to this question first. Does Jane Goodall believe all living, quote, ape-like species have been discovered? What about Bigfoot or the Hobbit? I know you any update on Sasquatch at all? I know you believe in Sasquatch. Any new discoveries on that?
Well, the last people I was speaking to was in Australia talking about the Yowie, which is their equivalent of Sasquatch. I don't know if these creatures exist. All I know is that everywhere I've been, there are tales of them, and there are people who say they've seen them. So I'm not going to go out and say they're not there. There's something, and it's very strange, and I find it extremely fascinating.
Let's go to Dave in Rockford, Illinois. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
Go ahead.
It's an honor to talk to you. I was just wondering, I read somewhere that a lot of ranchers have been doing gene banking of their, you know, prized cattle and such. I was just wondering if you had been doing the same with the chimpanzees. I mean, you're talking about the dwindling numbers, and I was just wondering if you had frozen some DNA samples.
Not to my knowledge. I'm certainly not involved with anything like that, although in captive breeding, it is true that some sperm has been flown across the world. It was with the bonobo. But, you know, we haven't quite got down to needing to do that with chimpanzees yet. There's so many in zoos and sanctuaries around the world, and there are efforts made to help them to breed in such a way as to maximize the gene pool.
Berrigan in Second Life asks that question about bonobos. What are the prospects for bonobo populations?
Well, they and the orangutans, I think, are the worst hit of all the great apes. I suppose mountain gorillas as well. The lowland gorilla and the chimp have the larger populations left. And the bonobo, well, it really depends what's going to happen in DRC. That's the only place where they are. And that country is so unstable that conservation efforts have been rather difficult there.
The Congo there.
It's in the Congo, yes.
Yeah.
Kinshasa,
yeah.
Yes.
So the war that's going on around there doesn't make anything any better.
The bonobos are way north of the war, but the whole country is a sort of, it's very unsettled and very difficult to establish a long-term conservation program, which is what must happen if the bonobos are to be saved, except in zoos.
Mm-hmm. Dan in Indiana. Hi, Dan.
Yes, great to speak with both of you, Ira and Jane. I saw you out in, I think it was Washington, Jane, talking about saving the cougars and their habitat and stuff, and logging did seem to be the biggest reason that cougars were being diminished. And have you, especially with the environments you're dealing with, have you tried to get, like, the CEOs of these big companies to come out and see what they've actually done? Because, you know, they're just sitting at a desk somewhere, and they don't see a lot of this degradation they've caused. Or have you even went as far as maybe to boycott these companies?
Per se, but the book I'm working on now is about animals and plants rescued from the very brink of extinction. And there's some interesting stories there. And one that comes to mind is the Vancouver Island marmot in BC, in Canada. And there the numbers were down. I think there were just 12 individuals left. And Andrew Bryant was doing his PhD on the fate of the marmot. And every morning he'd arrive in the logging camp, because that's where his research place was, and he'd ride with them at about 4:30 in the morning. Mm-hmm. And one day one of the loggers said, well, you know, what are you doing up there? And he was trying to explain. He said, come with me on your day off and I'll show you. And that day, the guy saw one of these marmots who'd been tranquilized to be banded, marked, or however they do it. And he was so moved by the whole thing that he went back and told his CEO, and the CEO went up and was similarly moved, and as a result changed his entire logging practice so as to help the marmots. And now the marmots are springing back. There's, I think it's around 500. I met this guy, Andrew, last week when I was there.
Hmm. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, talking with Jane Goodall. Jane, when you went out to meet Louis Leakey all those many decades ago, did you ever foresee yourself having to be a crusader to save the life on the earth here?
I think you know the answer to that, don't you? I couldn't. And I back mean, then in 1960, you know, it was so different because this conservation threat wasn't there.
Yeah.
There were maybe way over a million chimpanzees. The African equatorial forest belt was virtually untouched. And it was after that that this massive invasion of foreign companies came into Africa and started messing everything up.
Mm-hmm. So where do you see yourself doing next? You've sort of evolved many times yourself over your lifetime. You think you're in your last stage of evolution of where you're heading? I mean, that you're in this one well, direction, you're going to change another direction? Or where do you see yourself going over the next
five to 10 years. I think I shall be carrying on, you know, it's 300 days a year on the road. It's Africa, Europe, North America. Next year, concentrating on the southern part of, you know, South America, Brazil, Central America. Normally, it's Asia. This year, Australia. Next year, India. The world's too big for me, actually, but I try and do as much as I can and start the Roots and Shoots group because this is the future. And if we can create a critical mass of youth that understands this life is about more than just money and that we need money to live, but we shouldn't be living for money. And, you know, all these groups tackle projects to make things better for people, for animals, for the environment, roll up their sleeves, get out and take action.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go on.
No, I was just saying that has this change of administration, do you think, will help you in your work anymore?
Oh, absolutely, without any question. We can put it the other way around and say that the last administration hindered us. I think there's a great big sigh of relief, and most of the people I know are feeling extremely hopeful about the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish you good luck. I guess there's no better way than to end our conversation by wishing you good luck going around the world 300 days of the year in your travels, and be safe and come back and visit us. And certainly when is your next book, do you think, will be out?
It'll be out on September. I think it's the 18th next year.
Oh, okay. Well, we have a date to look forward to.
Yeah, absolutely.
If not before then. Thank you, Jane, for taking time to be with us today. Good luck to you.
Thanks a lot. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Jane Goodall, she doesn't need any, you know, introduction what more can I say? She's a primatologist, an environmental advocate, and co-winner of the 2008 Leakey Prize, and the founder of the Jane Goodall Institute that's based in Arlington, Virginia. That's about all the time we have for today. If you'd like to write to us, send us some regular classic mail to Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Thank all of you for Twittering today. That's continue going during the week. If you want to tweet us, you can send it to @SciFritter. That's @SciFritter. We may change that back to SciFry, make it a lot easier for folks when we get a chance to do that. Also, we've got the Science Friday Pick of the Week at sciencefriday.com. What happens when you blow up water balloons in weightlessness? Ooh, it's really interesting stuff. Watch the water balloons explode because they don't do what you think they're going to do. So you can see that video at sciencefriday.com. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.